next matter on calendar today is case number 60162, Macias versus State. Is counsel ready for the appellate to proceed?
Yes, sir.
And you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, please do.
Well, please the court. My name is William Waters. I'm a Clark County public defender, and I represent Mr. Macias. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may. And before this gets underway, I neglected to say at the outset that Justice Perry is unavoidably absent. He is participating in the deliberations, however. He's read the briefs, he will listen to today's oral argument, and he will participate in the decision. He regrets that he could not be here.
Thank you. Mr. Macias is an alcoholic, and Mr. Macias had prior DUI convictions, and Mr. Macias drove again, and given his prior convictions, he was charged by the state of Nevada with 3 counts of felony DUI, which is the third offense with the 2 prior misdemeanor offenses. Mr. Macias decided to avail himself of the statutory provisions that allow a deferred adjudication of the felony if he participates in a DUI treatment program. And what we call it in the district court is the DUI court or the SOP, Serious Offenders Program. So Mr. Macias applied, and he was accepted. And prior to waiving his preliminary hearing in justice court, he told the judge that I have been accepted, or through his attorney, I have been accepted. The public defender was appointed, obviously, because he was indigent. I've been accepted, and I intend to waive my preliminary hearing rights in order to avail myself of the treatment program in the district court. At that point, the case was transferred to the district court. When he formally entered his plea in front of the arraignment hearing master in the lower level, all proceedings were stayed at that point. He was not adjudged guilty. No JOC was ever filed. The arraignment hearing master referred the case to the DUI court, which at the time, Mr. Macias would have started, I believe, was being run by Judge Glass. And then, in the meantime, Judge Glass retired, as we're all aware, and Judge Delaney took over the program. But at that point that he entered his plea, and he was deemed amenable to treatment and sent to the DUI court, he had a due process right to continue the treatment. And because he had a due process right, when he was going to be terminated, he had right to notice, opportunity to be heard, opportunity to contest the violations that were leading to his termination from the DUI court, opportunity to obtain counsel if he could afford it, and if he couldn't afford it, opportunity to have counsel appointed for him. Now, I think it bears mentioning that we were never withdrawn from the case, by the way. The public defender's office was still the attorney of record throughout the course of his participation in the DUI court. So the idea that Mr. Macias would have to assert his right to counsel, I mean, we were already there.
Does the public defender staff the DUI court?
We don't, Justice Gibbons. We didn't at the time. You know, my understanding is that that's going to change. Okay. And I'm glad you mentioned that because I know that the respondent made that issue in the district court as well, that somehow we give up any argument that he was denied due process merely because there was a decision made at the public defender's office to not staff the court. Now,
are you arguing for a larger body of due process rights than would be accorded your client had he been placed on probation at the time he was put in the DUI court program?
Well, yeah, and candidly, Justice Pickering, I kind of shot for the moon with that argument. I kind of recognize that that's asking a lot. My argument was basically that because he hadn't been adjudicated yet, there wasn't a finding of guilt, that perhaps additional due process rights would apply, that not necessarily there when you've got the condition of liberty of parole.
What about right to counsel, aren't
you? Well,
the counsel is giving would probably argue with you about the due process issue that you just raised with the chief.
Well, how so?
Well, it's a critical stage, right? It's a critical stage, a right to counsel.
Of course.
He had counsel. Did you just see appear in those particular proceedings?
And that gets back to Justice Gibbons' point. And the reason why he didn't appear, Justice Gibbons, and if I may, this isn't part of the record, but I think this is important. And I talked to Mr. Cohn recently about this, because I was curious as well. We were given assurances, because we didn't have the funds to staff the court. And it was an issue with the county commission not giving us the funds to staff the court. But Mr. Cohn was given assurances by Judge Glass, who was running the program at the time, that there would be representation for indigent defendants in the DUI court on a weekly basis. It was only at that point that Mr. Cohen was given assurances that our clients, our indigent clients, would have some counsel present while these decisions were being made, that he was like, okay, then that's fine, as long as, you know, we believe that, as long as you agree with us that there should be legal representation present during these court dates. Now, apparently that didn't happen. I don't know why that didn't happen.
So we're sort of down the road. I'd like to return your attention to what happens when a defendant is referred to the deferral court under this statute. The statute, I don't care about the practice. I want to know about the statutory interpretation. The statute says, immediately, without entering a judgment of conviction, and with the consent of the offender, suspend further proceedings and, quote, place the offender on probation for not more than 5 years. If that's what the statute mandates, then why does not your client have the right to an I hearing?
Well, and you're right. And I'm not going to be that that is at the very least what he's entitled to. Now, I'm a justice figure and was concerned about my lawyer, but you're right, Your Honor.
Before we reach for the moon,
right,
as you suggest, right, let's focus on the earth.
He should have been placed on probation. Decision not to place the offenders on, I mean, it's right there in the statute. We have to abide by the statute.
Is it the case that none of these cases result in a defendant being placed on probation? Is that because of some practice that exists?
Your Honor, in my time at the Public Defender's Office, when I started, the DUI court was a pilot program. It became law in 2007. I started in 2005. Since I've been a public defender, it has always been the practice not to place offenders on probation. I don't know why this decision was made. Obviously, that's above my pay grade. Those are decisions that are made by the district court, I presume. But you're right. Statutorily, he was
required. The lawyer representing this defendant at the time he was referred asked that he be placed on probation.
No, we did not do that. And I don't.
I have a follow-up question to that, because the plea agreement also says if he, the written plea agreement says that if he is permitted to undergo the program, I understand that I will be placed upon a period of probation not to exceed 5 years. Upon condition that I be accepted into a program of treatment. To me, that dovetails with the statute, and this becomes kind of a Wizard of Oz proceeding where the plea agreement says it, the statute says it, but there's some unwritten practice that that's not being honored. Is that right? Is that what you're telling us?
That's what I think is happening in this
case. Is that because no PSI is done on these?
No PSI is done on these, and that could be one of the reasons, Justice Cherry. But you're both correct. But the statute says that it should have been happening. Now,
and the plea agreement says that indeed it's happening.
I would just as a point of clarification, it's actually not a plea agreement because the state opted out of the agreement provision. If you look at the legislative history, the state didn't want to have to agree to the DUI court. So I understand we call them plea agreements, but there's actually no agreement with the state. It's a
so we're really entering into a document that is executed and signed and entitled and acts like a plea agreement.
There's another statute in the U.S. that actually says any time you're pleading with something that carries prison time or an enhancement on a misdemeanor, the plea has to be in writing. And just
according to your idea, it's just a wink and a nod plea because we're not complying with the statute to begin with.
Well, we're complying with the statute with respect to the plea, the formalized plea which is filed with the court. We're not.
It's entitled guilty plea and it's signed by your client.
Right. What's not being complied with is the requirement under the statute that offenders are placed on probation. And here's the thing, if he had been on probation, everyone's been a district court judge here, except for Your Honor, Justice Pickering, but we all know what happens at probation revocation hearings. Notice goes out to the party of what the alleged violations are. Attorney is appointed. Now, I know the respondent makes the argument that you're not entitled to an attorney at probation revocation hearing. I would assert that yes, there is case law from this court which does suggest that, Nays versus State. However, it also says that with respect to indigent probationers, you got to look at it case-by-case basis. Is he denying the violations or is there mitigating evidence that would render...
But which court sends the notice out? Is it the sentencing court?
Sentencing court, correct.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be the DUI court?
No, it wouldn't be the DUI court. And that's why, if you had that, I mean, all we're really looking for is some hearing, like some hearing that comports with due process prior to termination. Call it a revocation hearing, probation revocation hearing, call it a DUI court termination hearing. We don't care what it's called, as long as you have it. And, if the DUI court wants to refer the case back to the Division Department for purpose of noticing this hearing, and quite frankly, Justice Pittman, I think that that's probably where the hearing should take place in the Division Department, because the problem we have is because the DUI court judge works so closely with the treatment providers in the DUI court that I personally believe it would be very difficult for her to be unbiased.
So if this had played out in your mind perfectly, what would have happened here? According to law, he would have been placed on probation?
Correct. And the alleged violations of the DUI court would have become probation violations. We would have been entitled to a probation hearing.
So the DUI court cannot carry into effect a consequence for a violation of the conditions that it's imposed on the treatment? Is that your position without a formal...
Well, that's a good question. Can they find people in contempt for missing a UA? I think that we all agree that they can do things like that. But when it comes to, that's it, you're out of the program. The program that you have a liberty interest in because you're going to be sent to prison now that you're out, when it comes to that kind of decision, I don't think that the DUI court is the one who's in the best position to handle.
I'm sorry, please complete.
To handle that decision. Now, yes, certain things that happen on a day-to-day basis, you give a sample that had a low creatinine level. Like, we can sanction you for that because we tell you you're not supposed to do that. It indicates that maybe you're flushing. We're going to give you 5 days contempt. I think the DUI court can do those sort of things, but that's not being terminated from the program at that point. So I think once you get to that point where it's like, okay, you're out, and now the statutory trigger of mandatory prison kicks in, I think you need a more impartial court. I just read yesterday, actually, the Mosley versus Commissioner on Discipline, which actually says that it's a denial of due process when you have the hearing body, in whichever context it is, who's not really unbiased. Now, I am not casting dispersions upon Judge Laney. She's a fine jurist. It's just that she works so closely with the treatment providers in the DUI court, she's never going to not side with them. If they're saying that this guy, Lucio Macias, was seen driving, even though we contend that there was absolutely no evidence to prove that.
Isn't it an easy argument? You could ask Mr. Nelson the exact same question. Do we even have to get to any of this if there's no compliance with the statute? Isn't there just an easy way for you to get to this?
I mean, non-compliance with the statute, so what you're suggesting is because he drove without a breath and an elect device, we don't have to have a hearing because may I continue the answer?
I hope so.
The idea that, I thought about that. Like, well, if you can just point to some provision of the statute that does lay out the factors that you must do in order to participate, and failure to do that would warrant a termination, But again, and this is a situation where he's denying that he violated that provision of the statute. He's saying, I didn't drive without a breath and a lock device, and the only evidence that I did is some unknown person, I don't even know who it is, who maybe was a participant in counseling, who kind of saw me one day, I don't know.
But isn't that a bit of a stretch? Because my understanding was he owned a car that was tied up to him that he admitted did not have a BID device on it, and that in and of itself, irrespective of driving, constituted the violation.
Well, and here's the thing, Justice Pickering. That was arguably a violation of Judge Delaney's DUI court participation rules, not necessarily a violation of the statute.
Right.
The statute says you
not
have
less than
a BID for a minimum of, you can't drive a car without a BID installed for a minimum of 12 months. Mr. Macias was in the program for 2 years at that point, so statutorily, he probably wasn't required to have a BID on any car if he was driving or not.
Let's get you back on safer ground. We have a situation where this person, pursuant to statute, supposed to be put on probation. He's not put on probation. He's voluntarily, it seems, he's in this DUI court. Was he given any written rules that he must follow or why he would be kicked out of this program allegedly?
I believe they are, yes. They're given like the rules of the program and what they're expected to do and what they're expected to comply with. Yes, they are.
And do you know if he signed those or not?
I haven't seen his signed signature in order.
I said because the court had opined on the specialty court case, when you put someone in specialty court, that you have to make them aware of the rules of the court and you're supposed to sign off before you can effectuate a court non-compliance with those rules and regulations. And then the other part, there seems to be two different parts of this argument that we're mashing together. One is the duty of the court itself, and the court of the original rendition, where he purportedly entered a plea that was held in abeyance, where he wasn't put on probation. Is that a fair...
Yeah, that's true. Because the statute doesn't talk about a DUI court, quote-unquote. It talks about a treatment program. And I know that Savage, which this court decided back in 2009, talks about that in sort of... It was a case that came out of the rural counties, and they said, this is an unfunded mandate. You're forcing us to create a DUI court. And this court said, no, we're not. We're talking about programs of treatment. If you choose to have a DUI court because you have the funds, that's fine. You can do that. But we're not mandating you do that. So... That's the thing. Judge Vernon is actually, I hate to borrow the respondent's argument, but I think they were right at one point in this litigation, because I think that they put forward this idea that Judge Vernon is actually not really acting as a judge in the traditional sense when she's supervising DUI court. She's more supervising the treatment of the offender.
Are you going with both prongs of failure to follow the statute as well as the due process?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the statute... The legislature passed that statute and they put in there that right to a hearing, a pre-termination hearing, quite frankly, because it says prior to, well, post-termination of the program, but pre-sentencing. So like, at that point, there's still an opportunity for the defendant, because the statute says to determine whether the offender should be sentenced. It implies that sentencing is not a guarantee. Prison is not a guarantee at that point. So, yes, there's a statutory right to a hearing pursuant to your... Litigate 330, and then there's the due process right to a hearing pursuant to, you know, just the due process clause of the Constitution, and the requirement of probation. But frankly, I think we'd all agree that if Mr. Macias was placed on probation, and quite candidly, that's the fault of the court, we wouldn't be having this discussion because he would have been entitled to that probation revocation.
That's just as hard as he was trying to do clearing the facts in this case. Is this a conditional plea?
It is not.
He writes and he signs it, but the court doesn't enter it.
Exactly.
Or he just submit it to the court.
It's not a conditional plea in the sense of, if I don't follow through with it, you can withdraw it. It's an entry of plea, but everything stops at that point. You're not found guilty. There's no JOC entered. So I hope that answers that question. Okay. I don't think I have any more time, but...
Thank you for your
question. Thank you.
Jesus, Mr. Nelson, it's like maybe I could phrase my question on it, because I'm still a little perplexed on this. The issue in the case, from my perspective, is this statute mandate probate the defendant placed on probation? If the judge didn't do it, is it error, or does it have to reverse? If the answer is yes, you have to place on probation, that may answer the counsel issues and some of the others. So I don't think I heard a clear-cut answer to that question, so I'd be curious what the state thinks about that, and then Mr. Waters, if you get a chance to make a rebuttal on what you think about that, too.
Speaking of Justice Gibbons and Mr. Nelson, that was precisely my question.
Okay.
If we start way back, where he was supposed to, the statute thinks he's supposed to be placed on probation, doesn't the argument at least for the side end there?
Well, Justice, I hate to sound like counsel for President Clinton, but that depends on what you mean by probation. Probation, normally, formal, typical probation, is the defendant enters a plea, the defendant receives the sentence is suspended, and then the defendant's ordered to do certain things, and the suspended sentence, which is typically imprisonment, is imposed if he doesn't, and it's vacated if he does. In this case, that cannot be the type of probation envisioned by the legislature, because the legislature said in this case, you enter your plea, you have to enter your plea, by the way, you have to plead guilty or narrow. Then everything is stayed, assuming the court then determines that you qualify for DUI court. You do the DUI court. If you pass, you're sentenced to a DUI second offense. If you fail, you're sentenced to a DUI third offense. So this cannot be traditional probation by the way these statutes are set up. The legislature did not intend that the defendant be on typical traditional probation where, for example, he's monitored by the Department of Parole and Probation.
Why not? I mean, the statute says the court shall place the offender on probation.
Well, it'd be our position that the defendant is, in fact, on probation. He's simply on informal probation, the type of probation that this court recognized in State v. Busfing, 286 P3rd 599, where the court noted that the defendant was on informal probation, would be placed on that by Judge Mosley, and he'd been told do your community service, and that's all you have to do. Well, in this case, the only requirement on the defendant is do DUI court. Now, this court did hold in Savage, for example, that the court can order the Department of Parole and Probation to monitor the defendant. But one of the few things the defense and the state agree on in this case is that's not necessary in the 8th Judicial District Court because the defendant's already being monitored by the court, by house arrest, by his counselor. Savage dealt with a situation where the defendant was sent to a private counseling service that the court did not basically operate, the court merely supervised. So there's a need for supervision perhaps when they're in a private counseling program, but there is not a need when they're before the 8th Judicial District Court because that court is monitoring them.
Mr. Morrison, if we follow along the way that you're taking this right now, then to go back to Justice Scalia's comment, is that do you have a right to counsel and do you have a right to understand the rules of the program and then be formally noticed that you are allegedly in violation?
Well, Justice Douglas, there are two answers to that question, and frankly, it doesn't matter which one is correct in this case, because in either event, the defendant had all the process he was due. It would be our position, as set forth by the Kentucky court.
Why don't you outline what process he received, so we know the process?
Well, the process he received was, first of all, he was told by Judge Delaney that you had violated the terms of the DUI court, and he did that in several ways. He owned a vehicle that was registered to him that did not have a breath emission interlock device or a BID. He did not disclose that to the court, and most importantly, when he was asked by the counselor, do you have a BID in this car, he lied and said, yes, I do. She told him, bring in paperwork. The paperwork showed that he actually put it in afterwards.
I asked Mr. Waters if he ever received a written document outlining how this program was going to run and what might be considered violations or anything else, and also, in essence, was he apprised of those charges prior to this hearing that you're telling me took place?
Did he receive a specific document? I believe he did, but in this case, his violation was noncompliance with the
statute. Do you know if he signed it?
That I do not know.
I can help you out here on this, and it's back to my problem with the plea agreement, or the guilty plea that was in it, the written plea. It says, I understand and agree that I must install at my own expense an approved breath ignition interlock device in any vehicle I own or operate, and that I may not drive any vehicle unless it is equipped with such a device. That's in the guilty plea.
Yes.
But the problem I'm having is why is the state not conceding that effectively this is probation and the usual probation revocation rules apply and the safeguards that are attendant to those? I'm sort of mystified by that.
Well, the Kentucky court addressed that issue when the defendant was removed from drug court. What they said is, look, removal from drug court is not a sentence. It is not a guarantee of a sentence, and a defendant has no more right to have his attorney present when he's removed from drug court than if he's kicked out of a low management class. But assuming for the sake of argument that he is entitled to counsel, that counsel should have been present, counsel was not present at the first hearing, but counsel was certainly present at the rehearing. Counsel had an opportunity at that rehearing to present whatever defense the defendant wanted to for the defendant. The court heard that, and Judge Delaney reaffirmed her decision to remove the defendant from DUI court.
Mr. Nelson, did you finish your thought out?
So I was just going to say, assuming for the sake of argument, this court determines that counsel is mandatory, counsel was given in this case, and the defendant did not suffer any prejudice. The other point I'd make is he also had counsel when he was sentenced, when the case was referred back to the sentencing court, and that court did not have to sentence him, as the defense said, because we know from the Savage case that a court can set up its own counseling program. So the sentencing court would have had the option to say, Mr. Defendant, you have failed the 8th Judicial District Court, DUI court, but I'm going to send you to this private counseling instead. And as long as that private counseling otherwise complied with the statute, the sentencing court would have the power to do that. That's where the defendant is sentenced, not when he's removed from DUI court, and that distinguishes a probation or parole revocation hearing where the defendant has a suspended sentence imposed from simply removal from a program that the defendant has been ordered to do. But as I said, it really doesn't matter because the defendant had multiple hearings with his attorney present, his motion for rehearing and his sentencing. Now, the defense says, well, the motion for rehearing isn't fair because Judge Delaney already determined to remove the defendant from the program, but if that's true, then how can any court ever rehear a matter? I mean, if a court makes a decision on a motion and a rehearing is granted, the same court hears the rehearing. But according to the defense, they can't because they're prejudiced. The defense also argues in their brief, well, we didn't get a chance to call witnesses, but they never asked to. Now, let me make it clear.
If they asked for an evidentiary hearing on that in the motion to reconsider, I believe that they did. They wanted to cross-examine his accuser, if you will.
Well, that's
quite clear in the record.
Well, that's the interesting thing. The accuser in this case is not, as the defense represents, the person who turned him into the counselor. Because what happened was that person said, this guy isn't following the rules. The counselor then went to the defendant and said, you're not following the rules. You have this car. When did you put in the breath ignition interlock device? And
well, how do we know that? How do we know that?
We know that because we have a letter from the counselor that was attached to our initial brief in which she outlines what occurred. The defense could have called that counselor to testify, but the person who initially turned the defendant in, and that's the thing I can analogize it to, is say someone calls 911 and says there's a reckless driver at 95 and Jones. The police go there and they see somebody driving backwards on the freeway. That person gets arrested. Well, the police independently observed the violation, so whether they made the anonymous 911 call doesn't matter. So the person they could have confronted was the counselor, but they did not ask to do that. They did ask for an evidentiary hearing, but they never subpoenaed the counselor or anything else. And by the way, if they felt Judge Delaney was biased, why didn't they move to disqualify her at the motion for a rehearing?
Mr. Nelson, under a denied hearing request, the state would have to show more than produce a letter.
Well, the state did produce more than a letter because the defendant made admissions about, I mean, the court saw that the defendant said, I had this interlock in my car, and then they saw the paperwork that showed he got it 5 days later.
In this letter?
Well, in this letter, and I believe the court did some of its own independent work because it repeatedly, during the motion for rehearing, corrected the defense and said, look, you're not being thrown out for what the people said, you're being thrown out for what you admitted to. And just as an aside, he also admitted to the parole and probation writer when he was finally sentenced that he did in fact drive the vehicle without a breath.
I'm a little bit concerned about the Kentucky analysis. It assumes that all treatment facilities programs are the same, which in Nevada is not the case. And suppose this hypothetical, what would your position be? Had this event occurred in Lander County, and in that case, the judge transferred the defendant to a treatment facility supervised by a counselor. Counselor is presented with the same information. The counselor determines that this person is no longer qualified to be in the program and kicks him out. The judge then sentences them to prison. No hearings ever taken place, although requests had been made. The role of Judge Delaney is similar to that of the counselor.
Somewhat, yes, but in that situation there's a private counselor, and obviously the defendant doesn't have the right to take an attorney with him to every one of his counseling sessions any more than he has a right to have his attorney present if he is on parole.
No, but in that situation, shouldn't the defendant have the right to have counsel and a hearing, particularly where it's requested, before a judicial officer who's going to sentence him or her?
Well, the defendant would have the right in that case because when the defendant's being sentenced, he would be able to present his evidence at that time, just like the defendant in this case could have when he was sentenced by Judge Silver and the other judges.
I appreciate the point you make about the rehearing, but it seems to me that looking at these circumstances, you have to examine it so that Judge Delaney's role is quite similar to the role of the counselor in a rural county. Otherwise, you've got different forms of approach and justice in Nevada.
Well, her position is similar to a judge in a rural county. Well, actually,
the counselor,
correct. The counselor, her role is similar because all she can do is remove the person. The person then gets their due process hearing when they are sentenced, which the defendant got.
So your point is the due process probation revocation hearing in effect occurred with the sentencing courts 15, 17, or whatever the third department was?
Yes, Justice. In addition, it is our position the due process hearing occurred when the rehearing occurred because counsel was present.
So you want to ride both horses, Justice?
Basically, yes. I'll ride either one. Both of them together certainly get me where I'm going.
And you know, Mr. Benson, I'm going to join that, because it sounds to me like we are playing fast and loose with sometimes we have standard rules, hearings, due process. But you know, I've read this freedom several times. And I'm going back to that because I'm troubled by it. A client of this, of the PD's office, signs a plea agreement that is not in the least bit consistent with the practice that I'm hearing you all tell me that these offenders are subjected to. And that concerns me. You know, this morning we heard from, in a family case, a family practitioner who said family court is inherently different than other courts. Are you telling me that even though we sign a plea agreement in the criminal courts, in the 8th Judicial District Court, that DUI court is inherently different from any other court, and therefore we can have this guy sign this with all the understandings that are set forth therein, but they don't really apply to him?
The DUI court is different in a couple of senses. One, it's a treatment program coordinator or overseer, not a court.
I'm worried about the actual agreement that you signed.
There is one difference, as I mentioned. The defendant is on probation, but he is not on formal probation because the statute says he is not sentenced until he either passes or fails the
program.
Does
it say that in the agreement that he signs where he's waiving other rights?
Well, he's not waiving anything. He's saying, do the program. If you pass, you get this result. If you fail, you get this result. You're on probation. He's simply on informal probation. And again, Justice, perhaps if we want to make the probation formal probation, it still doesn't matter in this case because how is the defendant prejudiced? He got a hearing with his counsel, and as I already alluded to, or he's not entitled to it. The fact that he wasn't supervised by PNP simply means he might have gotten caught a little sooner if he had been, but that's hardly prejudice to the defendant. So, Justices, unless you have any other questions, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Do I have any rebuttal with 2 seconds?
You didn't have any left, but I'll give you 2 minutes. Thanks.
Thank you, Justice Pickering. I appreciate that. Just briefly, we did not have a hearing. We filed a motion to reconsider, and we were trying to get the hearing. We were trying to say that we want to be able to cross-examine the people that are giving information against him. And it's page 244 of Appellant's Appendix Part 2, where Judge Laney says, just for the record, we don't get a hearing. You're not getting a hearing. But you know what? Because I think this is an important issue, and I think it might eventually end up in the United Supreme Court, I'm going to let you make your record as to why you think you're entitled to a hearing. And then I'll let you argue whether he should be allowed back into the program or not, even though I have already made up my mind that he's not getting back in. That's what that was.
And here's what about the sentencing for Departments 15 and 17?
That's hilarious for this reason, because I litigated against Mr. Nelson, where I have tried to convince a district court judge after termination of DUI court that you don't have to send him to prison. And Mr. Nelson went crazy. That's absolutely what has to happen. Are you kidding? You can't ask for anything short of prison at this point. You signed an agreement where you agreed you're going to prison. So with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, the idea that I could have rolled into Department 15 and said, look, Judge Silver, even though you signed an agreement saying that once he was terminated, he goes straight to prison, I'm going to ask you to do something different. Now, I have always been of the opinion that the statute does allow something short of going to prison if you're terminated. However, no district court judge agrees with me on that. None. They all say, no, the statute's clear. You fail, you go to prison, nothing short of that. So, you know.
So your point is that the DUI court must be the place where you get your hearing, even though you were summoned and advised.
At some point before sentencing. And your honors have another case pending before this court, State of Nevada, or Camille Cerullo versus the State of Nevada, that's pending with the exact same issue. My colleague, Ms. Navarro, is litigating that, where the state takes the position, the respondent takes the position that even if I went to Department 15 and said, don't send him to prison. This, in that appeal, the state says, well, now you've got a district court judge overruling another district court judge, which is prohibited by Rolfing versus district court. With with all due respect to the state of Nevada in this case, their position has changed any time it is most expedient for them to change their position. They have not been consistent from day one in this case. And they keep running, quite frankly.
So could you,
it's concerning.
Backing up, could you, if you were writing the letter and not the one you're wishing for under everything, but a rational order, what do you want us to do in this case?
Prior termination from the DUI court, participants are entitled to notice of what their violations are, opportunity to present witnesses on their behalf, opportunity to obtain counsel or have counsel appointed if they can't afford counsel in front of a neutral hearing body, which is the exact same standard that has existed in the state for ad infinitum pursuant to the probation statutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel, for your provocative arguments and excellent briefing on this matter. We'll stand in recess for 2 minutes.